Heath had taken charge of the whole enterprise with remarkable results. It was barely nightfall, and the butchery was almost done, the meat distributed to all the households on the ridge. She knew everyone, knew the number of mouths in each cabin, and parcelled out the meat and sweetbreads as they were cut. Not even Jamie could have managed it better, I thought, feeling a warm swell of pride in her. I glanced across at the table where Jamie lay swaddled in blankets. I'd wanted to move him upstairs to his bed, but he'd insisted on staying downstairs where he could hear, if not see, what was going on. "They're nearly finished with the butchering," I said, coming to lay a hand on his head, still flushed and blazing. "Brianna's done a wonderful job of it," I added, to distract us both.
"Has she?"
His eyes were half open, but fixed in a fever stare, that dream-soaked daze where shadows writhe in the wavering hot air over a fire. As I spoke, though, he came slowly back from wherever he had been, and his eyes met mine, heavy-lidded but clear, and he smiled faintly.
"That's good."
The hide had been pegged out to dry, the enormous liver sliced for quick searing, intestines taken to soak for cleaning, haunches to the shed for smoking, strips of meat taken off for drying into jerky, fat for rendering into suet and soap. Once stripped bare, the bones would be boiled for soup, salvaged for buttons. The prized hooves and horns sat bloodily discreet on my counter, brought in by Murdo Lindsay. Tacit trophies, I supposed, the 18th-century equivalent of 2 ears and a tail. I'd got the gallbladder, too, though that was simply by default. No one wanted it. But it was popularly assumed that I must have some medicinal use for almost any natural object. A greenish thing, the size of my fist, it sat oozing in a dish, looking rather sinister next to the set of detached and muddy hooves. Everyone on the ridge had come at the news, even Ronnie Sinclair from his cooper's shop at the foot of the slope. And little remained of the buffalo now, save a rack of scavenged bones. I caught the faint odour of roasting meat, of burning hickory wood and coffee, and pushed up the window all the way to let in the appetizing smells. Laughter and the crackle of fire came in on a gust of cold wind. It was warm in the surgery now, and the cold air from the window felt good against my flushed cheeks. "Are you hungry, Jamie?" I asked. I was starving myself, though I hadn't realized it till I smelled food. I closed my eyes and inhaled, buoyed up by the hearty scent of liver and onions.
"No," he said, sounding drowsy. "I don't fancy anything."
"You should eat a bit of soup if you can, before you fall asleep." I turned and smoothed the hair off his face, frowning a little as I looked at him. The flush had faded a bit, I thought. Hard to tell for sure in the uncertain light of fire and candle. We'd got enough honey water and herb tea into him so that his eyes were no longer sunken with dehydration, but the bones of cheek and jaw were still prominent. He hadn't eaten in more than 48 hours, and the fever was consuming an immense amount of energy, consuming his tissues.
"Do you need more hot water, ma'am?"
Lizzie appeared in the doorway, looking more dishevelled than usual. Jemmy clutched in her arms. She had lost her kerch, and her fine, fair hair had escaped from its bun. Jemmy had a good handful of it in his chubby fist and was yanking fretfully at it, making her squint with each yank.
"Mamma, mamma, mamma,"
he said, in an escalating whine that made it obvious that he'd been saying the same thing for quite some time.
"Mamma, mamma, mamma."
"No, I have enough, thank you, Lizzie." "Stop that, young man," I said, getting hold of Jemmy's hand and forcibly unpeeling his fat little fingers. "We don't pull hair." There was a small chuckle from the nest of blankets on the table behind me.
"You'd never ken it to look at ye, Sassenach."
"Mm." I turned my head and stared blankly at him for a moment, then followed the direction of his glance with my hand. Sure enough, my own cap had somehow disappeared, and my hair was standing out like a bramble bush. Attracted by the word hair, Jemmy abandoned Lizzie's fine locks, leaned over and grabbed a fistful of mine. "Mama, Mama, Mama, Mama." "Foo," I said crossly, reaching to disentangle him. "Let go, you little fiend. And why aren't you in bed anyway?"
"Mama, Mama, Mama."
"He wants his mother," Lizzie explained rather redundantly. "I've put him in his cot a dozen times, but he'll be climbing out again the instant my back's turned. I couldn't keep him."
The outer door opened, letting in a strong draught that made the embers in the brazier glow and smoke, and I heard the pad of bare feet on the oak boards in the hall. I'd heard the expression "blood to the eyebrows" before, but I hadn't seen it all that often, at least not outside the confines of a battlefield. Brianna's eyebrows were invisible, being red enough to have blended into the mask of gore over her face. Jemmy took a good look at her and turned down his mouth in an expression of doubtful distress, just this side of outright wails.
"It's me, baby," she assured him.
She reached out a hand toward him but stopped short of touching him. He didn't cry, but burrowed his face into Lizzie's shoulder, rejecting the notion that this apocalyptic vision had anything at all to do with the mother he'd been fussing for a few minutes earlier. Brianna ignored both her son's rejection and the fact that she was leaving footprints composed in equal parts of mud and blood all over the floor.
"Look," she said, holding out a closed fist to me.
Her hands were caked with dried blood, her fingernails crescents of black. She reverently uncurled her fingers to show me her treasure, a handful of tiny, wriggling white worms that made my heart give a quick bump of excitement.
"Are they the right kind?" she asked anxiously.
"I think so. Let me check."
I hastily dumped the wet leaves from the herb tea onto a small plate to give the worms a temporary refuge. Brianna gently deposited them on the mangled foliage and carried the plate to the counter where my microscope stood, as though the plate bore specks of gold dust rather than maggots. I picked up one of the worms with the edge of a fingernail and deposited it on a glass slide where it writhed unhappily in a futile search for nourishment. I beckoned to Bree to bring me another candle.
"Nothing but a mouth and a gut," I muttered, tilting the mirror to catch the light.
It was much too dim for microscopic work, but might just be sufficient for this.
"Voracious little buggers."
I held my breath, peering through the fragile eyepiece, straining to see. Ordinary blowfly and fleshfly larvae had one line visible on the body. Screwworm larvae had two. The lines were faint, invisible to the naked eye, but very important. Blowfly maggots ate carrion and only carrion, dead, decaying flesh. Screwworm larvae burrowed into the living flesh and consumed the live muscle and blood of their host. Nothing I wanted to insert into a fresh wound. I closed one eye to let the other adapt to the moving shadows in the eyepiece. The dark cylinder of the maggot's body writhed, twisting in all directions at once. One line was clearly visible. Was that another? I squinted until my eye began to water, but could see no more. Letting out the breath I'd been holding, I relaxed.
"Congratulations, Dar," Brianna said, moving to Jamie's side.
He opened one eye, which passed with a marked lack of enthusiasm down Brianna's figure. Stripped to a knee-length shift for butchering, she was splotched from head to toe with gouts of dark blood, and the muslin had stuck to her in random patches.
"Why?" he said. "For what?"
"The maggots! You did it," she explained.
She opened her other hand, revealing a misshapen blob of metal, a squashed rifle ball.
"The maggots were in a wound in the hindquarters. I dug this out of the hole behind them."
I laughed, as much from relief as from amusement.
"Jamie, you shot it in the arse?"
Jamie's mouth twitched a little.
"I didn't think I'd hit it at all," he said. "I was only trying to turn the herd towards Fergus."
He reached up a slow hand and took the ball, rolling it gently between his fingers.
"Maybe you should keep it for good luck," Brianna said.
She spoke lightly, but I could see the furrow between her invisible brows.
"Or to bite on while Mama is working on your leg."
"Too late,"
he said, with a very faint smile. It was then she caught sight of the small leather strip that lay on the table near his head, marked with overlapping crescents, the deep imprints of Jamie's teeth. She glanced at me, appalled. I lifted one shoulder slightly. I had spent more than an hour cleaning the wound in his leg, and it hadn't been easy on either of us. I cleared my throat and turned back to the maggots. From the corner of my eye, I saw Bree lay the back of her hand gently against Jamie's cheek. He turned his head and kissed her knuckles, blood notwithstanding.
"Then a fash, lassie," he said.
His voice was faint but steady.
"I'm fine."
I opened my mouth to say something, but caught sight of Bree's face and bit my tongue instead. She'd been working hard, and still had Jemmy and Roger to care for. She needn't worry for Jamie, too. Not yet. I dropped the maggots into a small bowl of sterile water and swished them rapidly round, then dumped them back on the bed of wet leaves. "It won't hurt," I said to Jamie, trying to reassure myself as much as him.
"Oh, aye," he said, with an unbecoming cynicism. "I've heard that one before." "Actually, she's right," said a soft, rasping voice behind me.
Roger had already had a quick wash. His dark hair lay damp against his collar, and his clothes were clean. Jemmy, half asleep, lay against his father's shoulder, dreamily sucking his thumb. Roger came over to the table to look down at Jamie.
"How is it, man?" he said quietly.
Jamie moved his head on the pillow, dismissive of discomfort.
"I'll do. That's good."
To my surprise, Roger grasped Jamie's shoulder in a brief gesture of comfort. I'd never seen him do that before, and once more I wondered just what had passed between them on the mountain.
"Masali's bringing up some beef tea, or rather, buffalo tea for him," Roger said, frowning slightly as he looked at me. "Maybe you'd best be having some too."
"Good idea," I said. I closed my eyes briefly and took a deep breath. Only when I sat down did I realize that I'd been on my feet since the early morning. Pain outlined every bone in my feet and legs, and I could feel the ache where I had broken my left tibia a few years before. Duty called, though. "Well, time and tide wait for no maggot," I said, struggling back to my feet. "Best get on with it." Jamie gave a small snort and stretched, then relaxed, his long body reluctantly readying itself. He watched with resignation while I fetched the plate of maggots and my forceps, then reached for the leather strip by his head.
"You'll not need that," Roger said.
He pulled up another stool and sat down.
"It's true what she said. The wee beasts don't hurt."
Jamie snorted again, and Roger grinned at him.
"Mind," he said, "they tickle something fierce. That's only if you think about it, though. If you can keep all thought of them out of your mind, why, there's nothing to it."
Jamie eyed him.
"You're a great comfort, Mackenzie," he said. "Thanks," said Roger, with a husk of a laugh. "Here, I brought you something."
He leaned forward and deposited a drowsy Jemmy into Jamie's arms. The little boy uttered a small squawk of surprise, then relaxed as Jamie's arms tightened about him in reflex. One chubby hand swung free, seeking anchorage, then found it.
"Hot,"
he murmured, smiling beatifically. Fist twined in Jamie's ruddy hair, he sighed deeply and went soundly to sleep on his grandfather's fever-warm chest. Jamie narrowed his eyes at me as I picked up the forceps. Then he gave a slight shrug, laid his stubbled cheek gently against Jemmy's silk-bright hair, and closed his own eyes, though the tenseness in his features was a marked contrast to the rounded piece of Jemmy's. It couldn't have been easier. I simply lifted away the fresh onion poultice and tucked the maggots one by one into the ulcerated slash marks on Jamie's calf. Roger circled behind me to watch.
"It looks almost like a leg again,"
he said, sounding surprised. I never thought it would. I smiled, though I didn't look round at him, too intent on my delicate work.
Leeches are very effective, I said, though your rather crude knife work may have been useful too. You left big enough holes that the pus and fluid were able to drain. That helped.
It was true. While the limb was still hot and grossly discoloured, the swelling had subsided markedly. The long stretch of shin bone and the delicate arch of foot and ankle were once more visible. I was under no illusions about the dangers still remaining. Infection, gangrene, sloughing. But nonetheless, my heart grew lighter. It was recognisably Jamie's leg. I pinched another maggot just behind the head with my forceps, careful not to crush it. I lifted the edge of the skin with the slender probe I held in my other hand and deftly inserted the tiny wiggling thing into the small pocket thus provided, trying to ignore the nastily spongy feel of the flesh under my fingers and my memory of Aaron Beardsley's foot. "Done," I said a moment later, and gently replaced the poultice. Stewed onion and garlic wrapped in muslin and soaked with penicillin broth would keep the wounds moist and draining. Renewed every hour or so, I hoped that the warmth of the poultices would also encourage circulation in the leg, and then a dressing of honey to prevent any further bacterial invasions. Concentration alone had kept my hands steady. Now it was done, and there was nothing more to do but wait. The saucer of wet leaves rattled against the counter as I set it down. I didn't think I had ever been so tired before. Chapter 93 Choices. Between them, Roger and Mr. Bug got Jamie up to our bedroom. I hadn't wanted to disturb his leg by moving him from the surgery, but he insisted.
"I dinna want you to be sleeping on the floor down here, Sassenach," he said, when I protested.
He smiled at me.
"You should be in your bed, but I ken you willna leave me alone, and so that means I must go and be in it too, aye?"
I would have argued further, but in all truth I was so tired that I wouldn't have complained much if he'd insisted we both sleep in the barn. Once he was settled, though, my doubts returned. "I'll joggle your leg," I said, hanging up my gown on one of the pegs. "I'll just make up a pallet by the fire here and..."
"You will not," he said definitely. "You'll sleep with me."
He lay back on the pillows, eyes closed, his hair an auburn tumble against the linen. His skin had begun to fade. It wasn't quite so red. It was, however, alarmingly pale where the tiny hemorrhages didn't stain it.
"You would argue on your deathbed," I said crossly. "You don't have to be constantly in charge, you know. You could lie still and let other people take care of things for once. What do you think would happen if..."
He opened his eyes and gave me a dark blue look.
"Sassenach," he said softly.
"What?"
"I would like you to touch me without hurting me. Just once before I sleep. Would you mind, Madge?"
I stopped and drew breath, terribly disconcerted at the realization that he was right. Caught up in the emergency and worry of his condition, everything I had done to him during the day had been painful, intrusive, or both. Masali, Brianna, Roger, Jemmy, all of them had touched him in gentleness, offering sympathy and comfort.
And I had been so terrified at the possibility of what might happen, of what I might be forced to do, that I'd taken no time, allowed no room for gentleness.
I looked away for a moment, blinking until the tears retreated. Then I stood and walked over to the bed, bent and kissed him very softly. I stroked the hair back from his forehead, smoothed his brows with my thumb. Arch Bug had shaved him. The skin of his cheek was smooth, hot against the side of my hand. His bones were hard under his skin, framing his strength. And yet he seemed suddenly fragile.
I felt fragile too. "I want you to sleep beside me, Sassenach," he whispered.
"All right. I smiled at him, my lips trembling only a little.
Let me brush out my hair.
I sat down in my shift, shook out my hair, and took up the brush. He watched me, not speaking, but with a faint smile on his lips as I worked. He liked to watch me brush my hair. I hoped it was as soothing to him as it was to me. There were noises downstairs, but they were muffled, safely distant. The shutters were ajar. Firelight flickered against the glass of the window from the dying bonfires in the yard. I glanced at the window, wondering if I ought to close the shutters.
"Leave them, Sassenach," he murmured from the bed. "I like to hear the talk."
The sound of voices from outside was comforting, rising and falling with small bursts of laughter. The sound of the brush was soft and regular, like surf on sand, and I felt the stress of the day lessen slowly, as though I could brush all the anxieties and dreads out of my hair as easily as tangles and bits of pumpkin vine. When at last I put down the brush and rose, Jamie's eyes were closed. I knelt to smother the fire, rose to blow out the candle, and went at last to bed. I eased myself gently into the bed beside him, not to jostle. He lay turned away from me on his side, and I turned toward him, echoing the curve of his body with my own, careful not to touch him. I lay very quietly, listening. All the house sounds had settled to their nighttime rhythm, the hiss of the fire and the rumble of wind in the flue, the sudden startling crack of the stairs as though some unwary foot had stepped upon a riser. Mr. Weems's adenoidal snoring reached me, reduced to a soothing buzz by the thickness of the intervening doors. There were still voices outside, muffled by distance, disjointed with drink and the lateness of the hour. All jovial, though, no sound of hostility or incipient violence. I didn't really care, though. The inhabitants of the ridge could hammer each other senseless and dance on the remains for all I cared. All my attention was focused on Jamie. His breathing was shallow, but even. His shoulders relaxed. I didn't want to disturb him. He needed rest above all things. At the same time, I ached to touch him. I wanted to reassure myself that he was here, alive beside me. But I also needed badly to know how things went with him. Was he feverish? Had the incipient infection in his leg blossomed in spite of the penicillin, spreading poison through his blood? I moved my head cautiously, bringing my face within an inch of his shirt-covered back, and breathed in slow and deep. I could feel the warmth of him on my face, but couldn't tell through the linen nightshirt just how hot he really was. He smelt faintly of the woods, more strongly of blood. The onions in the dressing gave off a bitter tang. So did his sweat. I inhaled again, testing the air. No scent of pus. Too early for the smell of gangrene, even if the rot was beginning, invisible under the bandages. I thought there was a strange scent about his skin, though. Something I hadn't smelled before. Necrosis of the tissue? Some breakdown product of the snake's venom? I blew a short breath through my nose and took in a fresh one, deeper.
"Do I stink very badly?" he inquired.
"Ugh!" I said, startled into biting my tongue, and he quivered slightly in what I took to be suppressed amusement.
"You sound like a wee truffle pig, Sassenach, snortling away back there."
"Oh, indeed," I said, a bit crossly. I touched the tender spot on my tongue.
"Well, at least you're awake." How do you feel?
Like a pile of mouldy tripes.
Very picturesque, I said. Can you be a trifle more specific?
I put a hand lightly on his side, and he let his breath out in a sound like a small moan.
Like a pile of mouldy tripes, he said,
and pausing to breathe heavily, added,
with maggots.
You'd joke on your deathbed, wouldn't you?
Even as I said it, I felt a tremor of unease. He would. And I hope this wasn't it.
Well, I'll try, Sassenach, he murmured, sounding drowsy. but I'm not really at my best under the circumstances.
Do you hurt much?
No, I'm just tired.
He sounded as though he were, in fact, too exhausted to search for the proper word, and had settled for that one by default.
Little wonder if you are.
I'll go and sleep somewhere else so you can rest. I made to throw back the covers and rise, but he stopped me, raising one hand slightly.
No, no. Dinna leave me.
His shoulder fell back toward me, and he tried to lift his head from the pillow. I felt still more uneasy when I realized that he was too weak even to turn over by himself.
I won't leave you.
Maybe I should sleep in the chair, though. I don't want to...
I'm cold, he said softly. I'm very cold.
I pressed my fingers lightly just under his breastbone, seeking the big abdominal pulse. His heartbeat was rapid, shallower than it should have been. He wasn't feverish. He didn't just feel cold. He was cold to the touch, his skin chilled and his fingers icy. I found that very alarming. No longer shy, I cuddled close against him, my breast squashing softly against his back, cheek resting on his shoulder blade. I concentrated as hard as I could on generating body heat, trying to radiate warmth through my skin and into his. So often he had enfolded me in the curve of his body, sheltering me, giving me the warmth of his big body. I wished passionately that I were bigger and could do the same for him now. As it was, I could do no more than cling to him like a small, fierce mustard plaster, and hope I had the same effect. Very gently, I found the hem of his shirt and pulled it up, then cupped my hands to fit the rounds of his buttocks. They tightened slightly in surprise, then relaxed. It occurred to me to wonder just why I felt I must lay hands on him, but I didn't trouble my mind with it. I had had the feeling many times before, and had long since given up worrying that it wasn't scientific. I could feel the faintly pebbled texture of the rash upon his skin, and the thought came unbidden of the lamia, a creature smooth and cool to the touch, a shapeshifter, passionately venomous, its nature infectious. A swift bite and the snake's poison spreading, slowing his heart, chilling his warm blood. I could imagine tiny scales rising under his skin in the dark. I forcibly repressed the thought, but not the shudder that went with it.
Claire, he said softly. Touch me.
I couldn't hear his heartbeat. I could hear mine, a thick, muffled sound in the ear pressed to the pillow. I slid my hand over the slope of his belly, and more slowly down, fingers parting the coarse, curly tangle, dipping low to cup the rounded shapes of him. What heat he had was here. I stroked him with a thumb and felt him stir. The breath went out of him in a long sigh, and his body seemed to grow heavier, sinking into the mattress as he relaxed. His flesh was like candle wax in my hand, smooth and silky as it warmed. I felt very odd, no longer frightened, but with all my senses at once preternaturally acute, and yet peaceful. I was no longer conscious of any sounds save Jamie's breathing and the beating of his heart. The darkness was filled with them. I had no conscious thought, but seemed to act purely by instinct, reaching down and under, seeking the heart of his heat in the centre of his being. Then I was moving. We were moving together. One hand reached down between us, up between his legs, my fingertips on the spot just behind his testicles. My other hand reached over, around, moving with the same rhythm that flexed my thighs and lifted my hips, thrusting against him from behind. I could have done it forever, and felt that perhaps I did. I had no sense of time passing, only of a dreamy peace and that slow, steady rhythm as we moved together in the dark. Somewhere, sometime, I felt a steady pulsing, first in one hand, then in both. It melded with the beat of his heart. He sighed, long and deep, and I felt the air rush from my own lungs. We lay silent and passed gently into unconsciousness together. I woke, feeling utterly peaceful. I lay still, without thought, listening to the thrum of blood through my veins, watching the drift of sunlit particles in the beam of light that fell through the half-open shutters. Then I remembered and flung myself over in bed, staring. His eyes were closed, and his skin was the colour of old ivory. His head was turned slightly away from me so that the cords of his neck stood out, but I couldn't see any pulse in his throat. He was still warm, or at least the bedclothes were still warm. I sniffed the air urgently. The room was fetid with the scent of onions and honey and fever sweat, but no stink of sudden death. I clapped a hand on the centre of his chest, and he jerked, startled, and opened his eyes. "You bastard," I said, so relieved to feel the rise of his chest as he drew breath that my voice trembled. "You tried to die on me, didn't you?" His chest rose and fell under my hand, and my own heart jerked and shuddered as though I'd been pulled back at the last moment from an unexpected precipice. He blinked at me. His eyes were heavy, still clouded with fever.
"It didn't take much effort, Sassamach," he said,
his voice soft and husky from sleep.
"Not dying was harder."
He made no pretense of not understanding me. In the light of day, I saw clearly what exhaustion and the after-effects of shock had stopped me seeing the night before. His insistence on his own bed, the open shutters so he could hear the voices of his family below, his tenants outside, and me beside him. He had, very carefully, and without saying a word to me, decided how and where he wanted to die. "You thought you were dying when we brought you up here, didn't you?" I asked. My voice sounded more bewildered than accusing. It took him a moment to answer, though he didn't look hesitant. It was more as though he was looking for the proper words.
"Well, I didn't ken for sure, no," he said slowly, "though I did feel very ill."
His eyes closed slowly, as though he were too tired to keep them open.
"I still do," he added,
in a detached sort of voice.
"You needn't worry, though. I've made my choice."
"What on earth do you mean by that?" I groped beneath the covers and found his wrist. He was warm, hot again, in fact, and with a pulse that was too fast, too shallow. Still, it was so different from the deathly chill I had felt in him the night before that my first reaction was relief. He took a couple of deep breaths, then turned his head and opened his eyes to look at me.
"I mean, I could have died last night."
He could, certainly. And yet that wasn't what he meant. He made it sound like a conscious...
"What do you mean you've made your choice? You've decided not to die after all?"
I tried to speak lightly, but it wasn't working very well. I remembered all too well that odd sense of timeless stillness that had surrounded us.
"It was very strange," he said. "And yet it wasn't strange at all."
He sounded faintly surprised.
"I think," I said carefully, keeping a thumb on his pulse,
"you'd better tell me just what happened." He actually smiled at that, though the smile was more in his eyes than his lips. Those were dry and painfully cracked in the corners. I touched his lips with a finger, wanting to go and fetch some soothing ointment for him, some water, some tea. But I put aside the impulse, steeling myself to stay and hear.
"I don't really know, Sassanach. Or rather I do, but I kind of think quite how to say it."
He still looked tired, but his eyes stayed open. They lingered on my face,
a vivid blue in the morning light, with an expression almost of curiosity, as though he hadn't seen me before.
"You are so beautiful," he said softly. "So very beautiful, Mukhriya."
My hands were covered with fading blue blotches and overlooked smears of buffalo blood. I could feel my hair clinging in unwashed tangles to my neck, and I could smell everything from the stale urine odour of dye to the reek of fear sweat on my body. And yet, whatever he saw lit his face as though he were looking at the full moon on a summer night, pure and lovely.
This ends Disc 38, The Fiery Cross, Disc 39.
His eyes stayed fixed on my face as he talked, absorbed, moving slightly as they seemed to trace my features.
"I felt very badly indeed when Arch and Roger Mack brought me up," he said. "Terribly sick, and my leg and my head both throbbing with each heartbeat, so much that I began to dread the next. And so I would listen to the speeches between."
"You wouldn't think it," he said, sounding vaguely surprised, "but there is a great deal of time between the beats of a heart." He had, he said, begun to hope in those spaces that the next beat wouldn't come. And slowly he realized that his heart was indeed slowing, and that the pain was growing remote, something separate from himself. His skin had grown colder, the fever fading from both body and mind, leaving the latter oddly clear.
"And this is where I canna really say, Sassenach."
He pulled his wrist from my grip in the intensity of his story and curled his fingers over mine.
"But I saw."
"Saw what?" And yet I already knew that he couldn't tell me. Like any doctor, I had seen sick people make up their minds to die, and I knew that look they sometimes had, eyes wide fixed on something in the distance. He hesitated, struggling to find words. I thought of something and jumped in to try to help. "There was an elderly woman," I said. "She died in the hospital where I was on staff, all her grown children with her. It was very peaceful." I looked down, my own eyes fixed on his fingers, still red and slightly swollen, interlaced with my own stained and bloody digits. "She died. She was dead. I could see her pulse had stopped. She wasn't breathing. All her children were by her bedside, weeping. And then, quite suddenly, her eyes opened. She wasn't looking at any of them, but she was seeing something. And she said, quite clearly, 'Oh!' Just like that, thrilled, like a little girl who's just seen something wonderful. And then she closed her eyes again." I looked up at him, blinking back tears. "Was it like that?" He nodded, speechless, and his hand tightened on mine.
"Something like," he said, very softly.
He had felt oddly suspended, in a place he could by no means describe, feeling completely at peace, and seeing very clearly.
"It was as if there was a... it wasn't a door exactly, but a passageway of some kind before me. And I could go through it if I wanted. And I did want to," he said, giving me a sideways glance and a shy smile.
He had known what lay behind him, too, and realized that for that moment he could choose, go forward or turn back.
"And that's when you asked me to touch you." "I knew you were the only thing that could bring me back," he said simply. "I didn't have the strength myself."
There was a huge lump in my throat. I couldn't speak, but squeezed his hand very tight. "Why?" I asked at last. "Why did you choose to stay?" My throat was still tight and my voice was hoarse. He heard it, and his hand tightened on mine,
a ghost of his usual firm grip, and yet with the memory of strength within it.
"Because you need me,"
he said very softly. "Not because you love me." He looked up then with a shadow of a smile.
"Sassenach, I'll love you now, and I will love you always. Whether I am dead, or you, whether we are together or apart. You know it is true," he said quietly and touched my face. "I know it of you, and you know it of me as well."
He bent his head then, the bright hair swinging down across his cheek.
"I didn't mean only you, Sassenach. I have work still to do. I thought for a bit that perhaps it wasn't so, that you all might manage with Roger Mack and old Arch, Joseph and the Beardsleys. But there is war coming, and for my sins..."
He grimaced slightly.
"I am a chief."
He shook his head slightly in resignation.
"God has made me what I am. He has given me the duty, and I must do it whatever the cost."
"The cost?" I echoed uneasily, hearing something harsher than resignation in his voice. He looked at me, then glanced, almost off-handed, toward the foot of the bed.
"My leg's no much worse," he said, matter-of-factly. "But it's no better. I think you'll have to take it off."
I sat in my surgery, staring out the window, trying to think of another way. There had to be something else I could do. Had to! He was right. The red streaks were still there. They hadn't advanced any further, but they were still there, ugly and threatening. The oral and topical penicillin had evidently had some effect on the infection, but not enough. The maggots were dealing nicely with the small abscesses, but they couldn't affect the underlying bacteremia that was poisoning his blood. I glanced up at the brown glass bottle. Only about a third full. It might help him hold his ground for a little longer, but there wasn't enough, and it wasn't likely to have sufficient effect, administered by mouth, to eradicate whatever deadly bacterium was multiplying in his blood. 10,000 to 10,000,000 milligrams, I murmured to myself. Recommended dosage of penicillin for bacteremia or sepsis, according to the Merck manual, the physician's basic desk reference. I glanced at Daniel Rawling's casebook, then back at the bottle. With no way of telling what concentration of penicillin I had, administration was likely still more efficacious than the combination of snake root and garlic Rawlings advised. But not enough to matter, I was afraid. The amputation saw was still lying on the counter where he had left it the day before. I'd given him my word, and he'd given it back. I clenched my hands, a feeling of unutterable frustration washing over me so strongly as almost to overwhelm my sense of despair. Why hadn't I started more penicillin brewing at once? How could I have been so feckless, so careless, so bloody fucking stupid? Why had I not insisted on going to Charleston, or at least Wilmington, in hopes of finding a glassblower who could make me the barrel and plunger for a hypodermic syringe? Surely I could have improvised something for a needle? All that difficulty, all that experimentation to get the precious substance in the first place, and now that I desperately needed it. A tentative movement at the open door made me turn round, struggling to get my face under control. I'd have to tell the household what was happening, and soon. But it would be better to choose my time and tell them all together. It was one of the Beardsleys. With their hair grown out and neatly trimmed to the same length by Lizzie, it was increasingly difficult to tell them apart, unless one was close enough to see their thumbs. Once they spoke, of course, it was simple. "Ma'am?" It was Kezzy. "Yes?" No doubt I sounded short, but it didn't matter. Kezzy couldn't distinguish nuances of speech. He was carrying a cloth bag. As he came into the room, I saw the bag twitch and change shape, and a small shudder of revulsion came over me. He saw that, and smiled a little. "This for himself," he said, in his loud, slightly flat voice, holding up the bag.
him, old Aaron, said this works good. A big snake bite you. Get you a very little un. Cut his head off, drink his blood.
He thrust out the bag, which I very gingerly accepted, holding it as far away from me as I could. The contents of the sack shifted again, making my skin crawl, and a faint buzzing noise issued through the cloth.
Thank you, I said faintly. I'll do something with it. Thank you.
Keziah beamed and bowed his way out, leaving me in personal custody of a sack containing what appeared to be a small but highly annoyed rattlesnake. I looked round frantically for some place to put it. I didn't dare throw it out of the window. Jemmy often played in the dooryard near the house. Finally, I pulled the big clear glass jar of salt over to the edge of the counter, and, holding the bag at arm's length, used my other hand to dump the salt out on the counter. I dropped the bag into the jar and slammed the lid back on it, then rushed to the other side of the room and collapsed on a stool, the backs of my knees sweaty with dread.
I didn't really mind snakes in theory.
In practice, though. Brianna poked her head through the door.
Mama, how's Da this morning?
Not all that well. My face evidently told her just how serious it was, for she came into the room and stood beside me, frowning.
Really bad? She asked softly.
And I nodded, unable to speak. She let her breath out in a deep sigh.
Can I help?
I let out an identical sigh and made a helpless gesture. I had one vague glimmering of an idea, or rather, the return of an idea I'd had in the back of my mind for some time. The only thing I can think of doing is to open the leg, cut down deep through the muscle, and pour what penicillin I have directly into the wounds. It's much more effective against bacterial infection if you can inject it rather than give it orally. Raw penicillin like this, I nodded at the bottle, is very unstable in the presence of acid. It's not likely enough would make it through the stomach to do any good.
That's more or less what Aunt Jenny did, isn't it? That's what made that huge scar on his thigh?
I nodded, wiping my palms unobtrusively over my knees. I didn't normally suffer from sweaty hands, but the feel of the amputation sore was much too clear in my memory. I'd have to do 2 or 3 deep cuts. It would likely cripple him permanently, but it might work.
I tried to give her a smile. I don't suppose MIT taught you how to engineer a hypodermic syringe, did it?
Why didn't you say so before? She said calmly. I don't know if I can make a syringe, but I'd be really surprised if I can't figure out something that does the same thing.
How long have we got?
I stared at her, my mouth half open, then shut it with a snap.
A few hours, at least.
I thought if we didn't get any improvement with the hot poultices, I'd have to either cut or amputate by this evening.
Amputate?
All the blood drained out of her face.
You can't do that.
I can, but my God, I don't want to. My hands curled hard, denying their skill.
Let me think, then.
Her face was still pale, but the shock was passing as her mind began to focus.
Oh, where's Mrs. Bug? I was going to leave Jemmy with her, but
she's gone. Are you sure she isn't just out in the hen coop?
No. I stopped there when I came up to the house. I didn't see her anywhere. And the kitchen fire is smoured.
That was more than odd. Mrs. Bug had come to the house as usual to make breakfast. What could have induced her to leave again? I hoped Arch hadn't suddenly been taken ill. That would just about put the cocked hat on things.
Where's Jemmy, then?
I asked, looking round for him. He didn't normally go far away from his mother, though he was beginning to wander a bit, as small boys did.
Lizzie took him upstairs to see Da. I'll ask her to look after him for a while.
Fine.
Oh!
My exclamation made her turn back at the door, eyebrows raised in question.
Do you think you could take that?
I gestured distastefully at the big glass jar. Outside, darling. Dispose of it somewhere.
Sure. What is it?
Curious, she walked over to the jar. The little rattlesnake had crawled out of its bag and was coiled up in a suspicious dark knot.
As she extended a hand toward the jar, it lunged, striking at the glass, and Rihanna jumped back with a yelp.
"Ifrin," she said.
And I laughed, in spite of the general stress and worry.
"Where did you get him, and what is he for?" she asked.
Recovering from the initial shock, she leaned forward cautiously and tapped lightly on the glass. The snake, who appeared irascible in the extreme, struck the side of the jar with an audible thump, and she jerked her hand away again.
Kezi brought him in. "Jamie is meant to drink his blood as a cure," I explained.
She reached out a cautious forefinger and traced the path of a small droplet of yellowish liquid sliding down the glass. 2 droplets, in fact.
"Look at that! He tried to bite me right through the glass.
That's a really mad snake. I guess he doesn't think much of the idea."
He didn't. He, if it was a he, was coiled again, tiny rattles vibrating in an absolute frenzy of animosity.
"Well, that's all right," I said, coming to stand beside her. "I'm sure Jamie wouldn't think much of the idea either. He's rather strongly anti-snake at the moment."
"Mm-hmm."
She was still staring at the little snake, a slight frown drawing down her thick red brows.
"Did Kezi say where he got it?"
"I didn't think to ask. Why?"
"It's getting cold out. Snakes hibernate, don't they, in dens?"
"Well, Dr. Brickell says they do," I replied rather dubiously. "The good doctor's Natural History of North Carolina made entertaining reading, but I took leave to doubt some of his observations, particularly those pertaining to snakes and crocodiles, of whose prowess he appeared to have a rather exaggerated opinion." She nodded, not taking her eyes off the snake.
"See, the thing is," she said, sounding rather dreamy, "pit vipers have beautiful engineering. Their jaws are disarticulated, so they can swallow prey bigger than they are, and their fangs fold back against the roof of their mouth when they aren't using them."
"Yes," I said, giving her a slightly fishy look, which she ignored.
"The fangs are hollow," she said,
and touched a finger to the glass, marking the spot where the venom had soaked into the linen cloth, leaving a small yellowish stain. "They're connected to a venom sac in the snake's cheek, and so when they bite down, the cheek muscles squeeze venom out of the sac and down through the fang into the prey, just like a..."
"Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I said.
She nodded, finally taking her eyes off the snake in order to look at me. I was thinking of trying to do something with a sharpened quill, but this would work lots better. It's already designed for the job.
"I see," I said, feeling a small surge of hope. "But you'll need a reservoir of some kind."
"First I need a bigger snake," she said practically, turning toward the door. "Let me go find Joe or Kezi and see if that one did come from a den, and if so, if there are more of them there."
She set off promptly on this mission, taking the glass jar with her and leaving me to return to a contemplation of the antibiotic situation with renewed hope. If I was going to be able to inject the solution, it needed to be strained and purified as much as possible. I would have liked to boil the solution, but didn't dare to. I didn't know whether high temperatures would destroy or inactivate raw penicillin, if, in fact, there still was active penicillin in there. The surge of hope I had experienced at Brianna's idea dimmed somewhat. Having a hypodermic apparatus wouldn't help if I had nothing useful to inject. Restlessly, I moved around the surgery, picking things up and putting them down again. Steeling myself, I put my hand on the saw again and closed my eyes, deliberately reliving the movements and sensations, trying also to recapture the sense of otherworldly detachment with which I had killed the buffalo. Of course, it was Jamie who'd been talking to the other world this time. "Nice of you to give him the choice," I thought sardonically. "I see you aren't going to make it easy on him, though."
But he wouldn't have asked for that. I opened my eyes, startled. I didn't know whether that answer came from my own subconscious or elsewhere, but there it was in my mind, and I recognized the truth of it. Jamie was accustomed to make his choice and abide by it, no matter the cost. He saw that living would likely mean the loss of his leg and all that that implied, and had accepted that as the natural price of his decision.
"Well, I don't bloody accept it," I said out loud, chin uplifted toward the window.
A cedar waxwing swinging on the end of a tree limb gave me a sharp look through his black robber's mask, decided I was mad but harmless, and went about his business. I pulled open the cupboard door, threw open the top of my medicine chest, and fetched a sheet of paper, quill, and ink from Jamie's study. A jar of dried red wintergreen berries. Extract of Pipsissewa. Slippery elm bark. Willow bark, cherry bark, fleabane, yarrow. Penicillin was by far the most effective of the antibiotics available, but it wasn't the only one. People had been waging war on germs for thousands of years without any notion what they were fighting. I knew that was some slight advantage. I began to make a list of the herbs I had on hand, and under each name all the uses that I knew for that herb, whether I had ever made such use of it or not. Any herb used to treat a septic condition was a possibility. Cleansing lacerations, treating mouth sores, treatment of diarrhea and dysentery. I heard footsteps in the kitchen and called to Mrs. Bug, wanting her to bring me a kettle of boiling water so I could set things to steeping at once. She appeared in the doorway, her cheeks bright pink from the cold and her hair coming down in untidy wisps from under her kerch, a large basket clutched in her arms. Before I could say anything, she came and plunked the basket down on the counter in front of me. Just behind her came her husband with another basket and a small open keg, from which came a pungent alcoholic scent. The air around them held a faint ripe smell like the distant reek of a garbage dump. "I did hear, you see, as how you'd not enough mould on hand," she started in, anxious but bright-eyed. "So I said to Arch, I said, we must go round to the houses nearabouts and see what we can fetch back with us for Mrs. Freezer, for after all, bread does go bad so quick when it's damp. And the good Lord kens that Mrs. Chisholm is a slattern, for all I'm sure she's a good heart. And what goings on there may be at her hearth, I'm sure I wouldn't have liked even to think about, but we—" I wasn't paying attention, but was staring at the results of the Bug's morning raid on the pantries and middens of the ridge. Crusts of bread, spoilt biscuit, half-rotted squash, bits of pie with the marks of teeth still visible in the pastry. A hodgepodge of gluey orts and decaying fragments, all sprouting moulds in patches of velvet blue and lichen green, interspersed with warty blobs of pink and yellow and dustings of splotchy white. The keg was half-filled with decaying corn, the resultant murky liquid rimmed with floating islands of blue mould.
"Evan Lindsay's pigs," Mr. Bug explained in a rare burst of loquacity.
Both bugs beamed at me, begrimed with their efforts.
"Thank you," I said,
feeling choked, and not only from the smell. I blinked, eyes watering slightly from the miasma of the corn liquor.
"Oh, thank you."
It was just after dark when I made my way upstairs, carrying my tray of potions and implements, feeling a mixture of excitement and trepidation. Jamie was propped on his pillows, surrounded by visitors. People had been coming by the house all day to see him and wish him well. A good many of them had simply stayed, and a host of anxious faces turned toward me as I came in, glimmering in the light of the candles. He looked very ill, flushed and drawn, and I wondered whether I ought to have chased the visitors away. I saw Murdo Lindsay take his hand, though, and squeeze it tight, and realised that the distraction and support of his company through the day was probably much more helpful to him than the rest that he wouldn't have taken in any case.
"Well, then," Jamie said, with a good assumption of casualness, "we're ready, I suppose."
He stretched his legs, flexing his toes hard under the blanket. Given the state of his leg, it must have hurt dreadfully, but I recognised that he was taking what he thought would be the last opportunity to move the limb, and bit the inside of my lip.
"Well, we're ready to have a go at something," I said,
smiling at him with an attempt at confident reassurance. "And anyone who would like to pray about it, please do." A rustle of surprise replaced the air of dread that had been sprung up at my appearance, and I saw Masali, who was holding a sleeping Joan with one hand, grope hastily in her pocket with the other to pull out her rosary. There was a rush to clear the bedside table, which was littered with books, papers, candle stubs, various treats brought up to tempt Jamie's appetite, all untouched. And for some unfathomable reason, the fretboard of a dulcimer